7 months.
If it please the court, this court should make a preliminary writ, absolutely, because there are sufficient uncontested facts to establish that plaintiff's claims are time barred. Find otherwise, it means that we have no statute of limitations. Initially and briefly, I would like to address certain procedural issues. Respondent has argued in length in his brief that the petition for writ of prohibition is not procedurally appropriate and that relator should be sanctioned. This court issued a preliminary writ of prohibition in the status quo of BP products under the same circumstances involved in our case. Motion for summary judgment based on the statute of limitations denied. This court granted a preliminary writ without any discussion of the procedural propriety. It made its preliminary writ absolute, ordering the trial court to grant, in part, the summary judgment on defendant's motion. However, that procedural propriety issue was actually raised, addressed, and resolved by this court just last month in status quo Bloomquist, which is now final. In Bloomquist, the court expressly held that the issuance of a writ of prohibition is an appropriate procedure to forbid the continuing prosecution of a time-barred claim, and rightfully so. This court held in Doe versus the Roman Catholic Diocese of Jefferson City, the defendant has a vested, that is, constitutional right to be free from suit if the applicable statute of limitations bars the claim's claim. That is precisely the case here, and that is the reason the preliminary writ should be made absolute. As to respondent's claim that our seeking this remedy is an abuse of the writ process, logically, no response is necessary.
Well, could you get on to the...
Yes, sir.
Your arguments are very well put in this area. We can, obviously, writs have been issued by judges, and you're getting sanctions is another issue. But can you get on to the distinguishing this from Powell?
Yes, sir.
Which I know you know very well.
Under Rule 7404, we're entitled to judgment if there are sufficient uncontested facts to establish that the plaintiff's crimes are time-barred. We know what the applicable statutes of limitations are that apply here. The 5-year statute of limitations, the tolling at age 21, and the key language in 516.100, which contains the language discussed above, when does the cause of action accrue? 516.100 tells us when damage resulting therefrom is sustained and capable of ascertainment. This court held in Powell that an objective standard is to be applied in determining when damage is capable of ascertainment. It must be determined objectively because otherwise, if we apply it subjectively, we have no statute of limitations. In this case, objectively, much of the plaintiff's damage was always capable of ascertainment because he has admitted that he always remembered certain uncontested facts that according to the allegations made in his petition and in his first amended petition, caused him substantial damage. Uncontested facts that he pleads constituted an assault and battery. He admits he always remembered from the time they occurred to the time 21 years later when he filed this lawsuit. Uncontested background facts are that this plaintiff was born in April of 1967. At the incidents of which he complains of here occurred beginning in November of 1984 and ending in March of 1985, at a time when this plaintiff was over 17 and a half years old to within weeks of his 18th birthday.
Were there any facts that he didn't remember until sometime later?
He claims that, although it's unclear in his deposition, Your Honor, because at one point there's an issue of fondling that he talks about that occurred in the fourth incident, which at one point it is unclear, but he does, that is a contested issue. It's not one of the facts that we say are without power. That point he does. But I would like to address the issues and the facts that he always agreed, which he always remembered. And those were that there were four incidents. He always remembered there were four incidents for which he seeks damage. And William Miller caused the plant to hyperventilate and become passed out or unconscious. That he was warned never to tell anyone, including his parents, about these so-called experiments. That Miller put hair gel in his hair. And that within 2 or 3 weeks of his 18th birthday, he was stripped to his underwear. That he was blindfolded and a knife was held to his throat. And again, he was told never. And it was they were alone when all this took place behind closed doors. Those are facts that occurred. They're uncontested. That he always remembered. Almost 18 years old when it took place.
Of course, that would have been actionable. He could have been actioned with the knife to his throat, and he could have brought that action within 5 years because he didn't know that. And then that would have been completed before the repressed memory issues would have come up. I mean,
absolutely, Your Honor. Those were all actionable causes at that time. And until he turned 26, he always remembered those. And according to his petition, all of these points are raised. And he says they actually caused him damage. In his First Amendment petition, he refers to the incident, which took place just weeks before his 18th birthday, as the knife brandishing incident when he was stripped and blindfolded. His testimony establishes that he remembered the incident. Not only at almost 18, but at 19, 20, 21. He remembered it while he was in military intelligence, interrogating foreign nationals while in the service in Korea. He remembered it at 25, 26, 27. He always remembered these things. When he was trained as a federal law enforcement officer, when he took law training courses where he reviewed such legal theories as mens rea, by any objective standard, he had knowledge of the fact of damage sufficient to put him on inquiry notice of a potentially actionable injury.
He did with incident number four as your argument. What about the prior three?
He always remembered those two all.
But they're not an assault. I mean, what's actionable about having him hyperventilate and pass out or putting hair gel on?
Well, if they're not actionable, Your Honor, then I don't know how they would form the basis of assault.
But they're, the second one, he's asserting sexual assault occurred during that time frame.
Right. But he knew, he doesn't have to know the full extent of his injury. He has to be put on notice that he has some injury so it's required. And that's what he should have done, and that's what he ultimately did.
So the one thing that he says he repressed was the sexual aspect of the
claim
of the incident.
That's all.
But the actual events were always recalled.
That's exactly
minus
right.
The sexual part.
The four incidents, although I would argue that being stripped of your underwear and blindfolded behind closed doors has a sexual overtone to it. Maybe not the full extent of which he mentions here. But as the court has known, as the court has held in Clemmy versus Best and other cases, he doesn't have to know the full extent. He just has to be put on inquiry notice. Now, the question is here whether there are uncontested facts that I've outlined, which you always remember, were enough to put a reasonably prudent person on inquiry notice of a potentially actionable injury. This court recognized in Powell that what might be objectively ascertainable to a young person, a young child, would be different to an older person, such as this nearly 18-year-old person, who experiencing and always remembering that he was blindfolded to his underwear.
Is it your contention that having always remembered at least part of these events, that there was some place he could go to ascertain the rest?
Yes, Your Honor, there is. I believe that's true. He could have done then what he ultimately did, go to a lawyer and then go into counseling and see what else is there. That's the point. Was this sufficient enough to put him on notice of a potentially actionable injury? I believe it was.
When did he eventually raise it? He was told not to tell anyone. When did he eventually tell someone?
Well, he did tell his father in 1991, which was before the statute of limitations had run. He did tell his father about the experiments then in 1991. If we review these facts in this case under Graham versus McGrath, which is a case which this court just recently refused transfer. It's a case from the Missouri Court of Appeals Eastern District. And Graham, the plaintiff, admitted that he always remembered the incident of abuse, which took place when he was between ages 11 and 13. But what he stated was that while he remembered the incidents, he did not understand them to constitute abuse subjectively. In affirming summary judgment in that case, the court held, quote, while a child victim may be unable to immediately recognize such harm, we fail to see how this inability prevents an adult with memory of the events of abuse from being on notice that harm may have occurred. Applying the grand decision to the facts of this case, we must ask whether the plaintiff, during his adult years, with memory of these uncontested events of abuse, objectively should have been on notice that harm may have occurred. He had this knowledge and he had it with him until he turned age 26. He had it until then. He had full knowledge of what was out there. The objective standards set out in Powell and discussed in Graham absolutely requires that the risk be made absolute.
Thank you, counsel. Your side.
May it please the court. Good morning. Obviously, I'd like to take this opportunity to respond to some things Wheeler said today in his briefs. But initially, however, I would like to stress that the plaintiff in this case, Mr. Bisno, absolutely acknowledges that prohibition can be an appropriate remedy for a trial court erroneously permits a claim to proceed to trial that is barred by the statute of limitations. And a perfect example of where prohibition was appropriately applied with respect to the statute of limitations is this court's very recent opinion in Bloomquist versus Schneider, where the trial court committed, quote, clear error, unquote, by applying the statutory tolling provision that the trial court herself acknowledged had been previously held unconstitutional by a United States Supreme Court precedent. Other examples where prohibition was appropriately applied with respect to a statute of limitations issue is this court's opinion in BP Products versus Ross and GE versus Gertner, both involving issues of first impression. In Ross, it had to do with what the statute of limitations is for injurious falsehood. In the Gertner case, had to do with impleading a third party after an underlying lawsuit had already expired. So the plaintiff acknowledged that this court may review a statute of limitations issue in prohibition. However, what this court's opinions in cases such as Morash and Dick Proctor and many other cases makes abundantly clear is that the use of the writ procedure must not be abused and must not be promiscuously brought. Rather, writs must be brought based upon a truly legitimate good faith basis, particularly where these.
Are you saying that Mr. Nose is acting in bad faith in this case?
Judge, what I'm saying is they have cited a technically legitimate basis. They have not provided legitimate support for that basis.
And well, but what about the support that if this is an objective standard?
Correct.
We have an individual who says he always remembered that he was made to hyperventilate, passed out, had hair gel put in, was told never to tell anybody, was stripped to his underwear, was blindfolded and put his knife to his throat. And he would have remembered all of that during all the relevant period of the statute of limitations. Why isn't that a good faith, if not a good faith, a meritorious argument for the grant of summary judgment?
Because the plaintiff. Well, A, there's no evidence that supports their allegation, but more importantly...
Okay, and no evidence that supports that. Tell me what you mean.
They allege that any reasonable person in the plaintiff's circumstances would have been put on notice of a harm merely by remembering non-sexual details.
Let's go back. Those events are conceded, aren't they? The events and the memory.
There's not a question of fact that he remembered the events Judge Price just said. Is
the non-sexual events,
right.
That's correct.
Well, okay. And that's your characterization.
Now, whether or not that's objective or not is legal. You don't have to bring in 100 people to say, I objectively would have remembered that.
Yes,
right?
Sir. I mean, and my position here is that you're being asked, this court specifically asked, to view that kind of vacuum, to disregard evidence that creates a genuine dispute of material fact.
Well, that doesn't mean he's doing anything wrong. That's just for you to bring out. Now, tell me all that other stuff that we ought to be considering from your point of view.
The situation, as this court said in Powell, the situation in which that conduct occurred. And this is laid out in the briefs. All this conduct occurred within the context of legitimate experiments. It didn't occur with a complete stranger grabbing him off the street saying...
Legitimate experiments? What kind of experiments? What scientific...
Psychological experiments.
Did you get a, was there a consent from the parents? Was there, what?
Judge, oh, I apologize. Over a 30-year period, this gentleman perfected this mousetrap, if you will, whereby he approached the students at his school. He was either principal or vice principal at these schools. He approached Mr. Biznaz, he approached all these gentlemen who testified and whose testimonies in the brief, with this ploy that he had permission of the Marianist Order. He was working on his master's degree in psychology. He needed to perform certain psychological experiments and tests towards getting this master's degree. And he asked these students, would you be willing to help me with these? Do you mind assisting me with these experiments?
And don't tell your parents? Don't tell anyone about it? That, okay.
Right. You know why? And again, it's explained in the briefs, but because they were psychological studies, you couldn't, he explained to them that you could not share this information with other people because then almost like cross-pollination or something, the results would be ruined.
And the issue here, of course, is I know you know and opposing counsel does, it's not if that states a claim, if that was reasonable for him to be involved in the conduct, but under an objective standard, whether he would have known, been put on notice of an injury and substantial damages, as opposed to when he subjectively learned that the wrongful conduct and it caused his injury. So a lot of what you're alleging is why he did this and why he may have acted how a typical teenager might have acted or might not have acted at that time. But our issue for the statute of limitations is an objective one, not his subjective thinking.
I fully agree. The test here is, what would a reasonable person in a plaintiff's situation, how would we react to that? Would he have been put on notice of a harm by memory of this purely non-sexual act?
But, I mean, it is a harm, whether or not he subjectively understood that. He was assaulted. I mean, whether it's a sexual component or not, when someone blindfolds you, makes you strip naked and holds a knife to your neck, that's assault.
He did not view it that way.
But that's subjective. And the issue is whether a reasonable person in that situation would have.
You're absolutely right, Judge. My burden of summary judgment would show that based on the evidence, I could produce evidence such that a different or contradictory conclusion can be reasonably drawn from the evidence as to the accrual date of the plaintiff's statute of limitations. And I represent that I have absolutely done that. I provided the testimony of several of other people that were subjected to the exact same conduct, who all interpreted it the same way. If you're attempting to determine an objective basis, I see no better method than to take a group of people who have had similarities, subject them to the same conduct, and then you start determining a basis of objective reactions. That's scientific method. That is what this brother Miller did.
Prior to going to the lawyer and getting this repressed memory stuff out, had he been in any kind of psychological or psychiatric treatment prior to that?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
What was the substance of the conversation with the father in 91?
In 90, he told him that he had assisted Brother Miller with his experiments.
But did he go into detail about what type of activities or what things he was asked to do?
Not particularly, no. He just mentioned to his father that it was a 3-day cross-country trip that they're taking in a car together. So that considered a lot of opportunity for father-son discussion. He mentioned that he had assisted Brother Miller with his experiments.
And
it's legitimate.
Any indication that he believed he was wronged in any way at that time?
Not in any way. Not in any way. And that's...
So more just informational than confessional?
Absolutely informational. And that's one thing I wanted to... Judge Sutherland had mentioned distinguish the Powell case for us here. I can distinguish the Powell case in several ways here, even though summary judgment was reversed by this court. There are significant differences between this case and that case. In Powell, as this court noted, possibly Judge Wolf noted, the plaintiff's own testimony contradicted his claim of repressed memory. We do not have that in this case. There is absolutely no contradictory evidence, any evidence that the plaintiff ever understood or appreciated he'd been wrong until the repressed memory or recollected memory of sexual abuse. Also in this situation, they took depositions of several of his ex-girlfriends, relatives across the country, And not one, they cannot produce one individual to come forward and say that he made any complaints at all.
Counsel, your argument seems to be premised on a reading of Powell saying he must have some memory of the sexual nature of the conduct in order for the statute of limitations to be triggered.
Not necessarily, Judge. In this situation, if a stranger had grabbed him off the street and subjected him to these non-sexual things, if Brother Miller had pulled him out of the hallway into a room and said, take your clothes off, I'm tying you up, then that should be sufficient. Realtor's argument then would have merit. We need to appreciate, as you say in Powell, the situation in which this occurred. And that's why I provided the testimony of the other individuals that were subjected to this. This was all this conduct that he has always remembered, his non-sexual conduct, has always remembered within the framework, the parameters of a legitimate psychological experiment.
And it wasn't until he read an article in the newspaper where someone else had made similar allegations that he realized that this was not appropriate.
Exactly. In 2005 is when he had facts sufficient enough for inquiry notice to say, I guess that wasn't legitimate. And that's when he went on his journey of trying to figure out what happened to him, and ultimately he recollected the abuse that occurred, which is, getting back to Powell, there was testimony from Powell's psychologist that seemed to contradict what the plaintiff was saying. In this situation, we don't have that.
Well, what about, if the person who'd been the subject of the experiments was a young woman, and the teacher had said, well, I'm going to do some experiments, strip down to your underwear, and I'm going to blindfold you and have you pass out, I think we'd find a sexual connotation to that. Why is it not the case because they're male?
I'm not saying that it is because they're men, Judge. I'm saying it was the context of the situation that they were led to believe back in the early 1960s, 70s, and early 80s when plaintiff Bisnoff's conduct occurred, that this was a teacher of his, this was a vice principal of his, and he or she, although it was an all male school, obviously, sincerely, objectively, as we've shown with all the other folks that were subjected to this, trusted and accepted this story that was being told to them. They were told prior to this happening, I'm going to do these things to you. I am going to do things to test your fear, to test your trust. I'm going to tie you up. It was full disclosure, and it was all under this rubric of this is a psychological test. This is what I need to do to you. This is all legitimate. And they believed it. And when you're asking, well, is that objectively reasonable? Every single person that has come forward to testify in this situation has testified consistently with plaintiff Bisnoff that they believed and trusted. The psychologist testified, as you'll see in the brief, that in his opinion, the majority of young, reasonable people would trust that sort of story, at least back 20, 30 years ago. Most importantly, Judge, and this is incredibly important, the testimony of two of Realtor's own representatives, their own people, including Father Hackenworth, who's the former head of the order, the provincial, the top guy, testified that because of, again, the situation, the circumstances, the way in which Brother Miller approached these kids on this, that it would not be unusual and it would not be unreasonable for these young men to have accepted and believed the story they were being told, that this conduct that they were participating in was actually legitimate. And that's why it's objective. And in my job in summary judgment to, again, show that there is a different contradictory conclusion that can be reasonably drawn. And I've done that by showing the testimony of other similarly situated individuals, the psychologist, the clergy abuse expert, and the testimony of Realtor's own witnesses who say it would not have been unusual, would not have been unreasonable for these young men to have believed this.
Is this especially true because it was clergy doing it versus like a public school teacher or something?
There's absolutely a religious component to it. And you see that throughout all the testimony of the young men, or former young men. Harry Suda, look at the testimony of Harry Suda. This happened to him back in the 60s. And he said, we really trusted these guys back then. We really, truly trusted the brothers and the priests. And yes, there's absolutely a component to that. The bottom line is, and my time's ending, is I'm not coming before you saying that he always remembered sexual abuse. And that is what the situation was in the Graham case. Graham was upheld because the plaintiff admitted always remembering sexual abuse. He just claimed he didn't understand that it was wrong or he had been harmed. We're not dealing with that situation. We're not coming forward saying he's always remembering sexual abuse. We're not coming forward saying a stranger or Brother Miller grabbed him without any explanation, without any pretense, and did these very weird things. It seems to me that Powell is very clear. You must appreciate the conduct within the situation, within the context and circumstances that have occurred. And that's what we're dealing with here. And one other thing I'd point out that's very different than Powell is, you know, in Powell, the plaintiff testified he avoided his abusers after the conduct. Exact opposite in this case. He testified, and all the young men whose testimony are in the briefs testified, they didn't avoid Brother Miller after the conduct because they thought what they did was right. They thought what they did was legitimate. No one felt kind of was wrong when it happened. No one tried to avoid him after this happened. They really sincerely thought that they participated in a legitimate study. And no one, that Relator has not provided the testimony of one individual that said, yeah, I knew it was wrong, or I suspected it was wrong, or I felt, as Powell said, I felt disgusted, sick in my stomach. We don't have any of that. And so that's why I have to keep reiterating, it is the situation, the context in which must be considered in this situation. And my time is over.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The first thing I'd like to mention is that in our reply brief, we do point out that the plaintiff testified in his interrogatory answers that he avoided Brother Miller following the fourth incident because he felt uncomfortable. That's the fact of the matter. The other fact of the matter is with regard to Father O'Shaughnessy and Father Hackenworth, they were never presented questions that said, is it okay? Would you think a brother would be trusted if the brother asked someone to strip to his underwear, to be blindfolded with a knife to his throat? That was never asked of them. The reference to Harry Suda. Harry Suda said in 1981, I thought something was up. Harry Suda was never blindfolded. He was never stripped of his underwear, and he never had an active stroke. The other two people, both of which have been dismissed or on appeal, represented by Mr. Craig, Mr. Clumpers and Gabler, both of which said they were never in their underwear. Those are apples and oranges, totally. The other fellow is somebody I don't know anything about. He's in Colorado, but he's got a lawsuit. Now, this plaintiff wants you to replace your opinion in Powell, the objective standard, with a subjective standard. This is the only way his claim is not time-barred.
Well, what is the evidence of what he is told and consented to regarding the experiments?
That he always remembered, Your Honor, he always remembered being told not to tell anybody about this. He always remembered he was stripped to his underwear.
Yeah, but what about the nature, that it was the nature of an experiment, and did he consent to that?
He was told that these were experiments. He was told to come in. The fact of the matter is, as he pointed out, Brother Miller, this plant never knew Brother Miller.
Well, let me put it in our argumentative form. If I'm a student and a teacher and assistant principal ask me to participate in an experiment, would not I objectively believe that not to be an assault?
I think until the experiment goes behind closed doors, before the experiment includes a blindfold, before the experiment includes a knife to your throat, Your Honor, and when you're told to strip to your underwear. I think an 18-year-old back in 1985 or any other time knows that that's not right and knows that he's on notice. That, and besides that, as it was talked about in Graham versus McGrath, he has all this information with him throughout all of these years. He's an interrogator in military intelligence. He's a federal law officer. He knows about mens rea. He has legal training. He knows something.
If I understand your argument, you're comparing it to Eastern District case, Graham, was that? But the Eastern District case where the child was 10 or 11, and I think the court said the child may not have known at that time, but once the child reached majority, should have reflected back on those times and realized at that point.
Exactly.
And you're saying even if he was subject to the influence and respect and so forth, the environment at the school when he was under 18 at some point during the 5 years, he should have realized?
During not only the 5 years, actually the 7 or 8 years, Judge, until he turned 26, he should have realized this. This plaintiff, and it's undisputed in his deposition, said he left the church. He disregarded his Catholic upbringing by the time he was in college. So whatever respect he held these brothers in, apparently he didn't hold them in that respect anymore.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted.